Well, Cambridge is famous for a triumvirate of philosophers. Sorry, it's the beginning of the year. I haven't stood up and talked in front of people for a few months. It's always a bit of a shock. Yes, Cambridge is famous for a triumvirate of philosophers. Many of you will have heard the names Russell, Moore, and Wittgenstein. Moore we know because of his influence on the Bloomsbury group, people like Virginia Woolf, his idea that beauty, truth, friendship are undefinable goods, and we should devote our lives to seeking them. Bertrand Russell, whose works in logic have had a profound impact, and who's known for his objections to the First World War, and his campaigning in his books on marriage and morals and so forth. And Wittgenstein, who is of Wittgenstein, the man with the poker, who has had such an enormous influence on the arts and the humanities outside philosophy. Cambridge rightly celebrates these figures. They're all up on the website. But there were many other characters in Cambridge in this period when Cambridge really made such an enormous contribution to analytic philosophy and in part responsible for the invention of analytic philosophy in the form that it now takes. Some of these characters, well, let me give you a list of some of the names of people who were influential. There was Ward. There was Stout, both of whom were very much influenced by psychology. There was Keynes, the father of John Maynard Keynes, who was working on the intersection between philosophy and economics. There was Constance Jones, who worked on ethics and was very much a follower of Sidgwick, who's the man after which this site is named. Whole variety of other philosophers who weren't in the philosophy faculty, like Richards, who was part of the Richards and Ogden team who wrote on The Meaning of Meanings and worked on literary criticism and its relationship to philosophy, and so on. All of these people, I think, created the environment which allowed these three great members of our triumvirate to flourish. Without them, philosophy would not have been the same here. Today I want to celebrate one of these characters, who is a well-known figure, but perhaps his contribution to debate here isn't properly understood. And that character is called Alfred North Whitehead. What I'm going to try and do is tell you a little about Whitehead the man, which will give you a background to understand some of his philosophical contribution, and then I'm going to try and explain what his philosophical contribution amounted to in his philosophy of nature and the primary categories that he insisted that we should use when trying to understand how the nature of the external world that we describe in physical science. I must say I'm rather nervous today, not just because I haven't spoken for a few months since we've had a long vacation, but also my parents are here, and my parents have never listened to me. I put in mind something, a remark my mother made to me some years ago when she picked up a paper I'd written and saw that I'd mentioned some works of a 19th century mathematician philosopher called Gottlob Frege, and she thought it strange that we were still talking about someone from the 19th century. And it is an interesting question about why, as philosophers, we should be so interested in talking about the history of the subject. It does sound rather as though we're rather less resting on our laurels and not really stepping up to the forefront. Well, let me just briefly justify why it is that I think it is worthwhile to carry on talking about these historical characters. I think the primary reason for it is that philosophy is a subject that works in the deep unknowns of human thought. Philosophers are people who, as were, embody an intellectual pioneering spirit. They move outward to the regions where we don't understand things yet. And as soon as we do understand things, they get dissatisfied and they push on to the next region of the unknown. So that's one feature of philosophy. Another feature, I think, is that philosophy, there's not such a subject as meta-philosophy. I mean, we can have science, we can investigate the physical world, investigate biology and physics, and so on, and then we can ask questions about the nature of biology or about the nature of physics. There seems to be a clear distinction between the subject and the meta-reflection upon the subject. That kind of distinction is very difficult to keep in place in philosophy. One of the things that we do as philosophers is we worry about what our subject is. And I think that's partly a feature of the fact that we are the people who are working out at the frontiers of human understanding. As part of trying to understand our subject, one of the things that we do is we place our own worldview. We try to get some perspective on our worldview and the way that it's evolved and the forces that are being brought to bear to shape it by contrasting it with previous worldviews embodied in earlier philosophies. So just as you might try to get some appreciation of your own contemporary culture by going to another part of the world and trying to live with people who embody a different culture, we as philosophers, we try to get some sense of what's intellectually driving us now by comparing ourselves with the previous era in philosophical thought. Because that's one of the reasons I think it's useful for philosophers to carry on working on the history of philosophy. And it's one of the particular strengths, I think, of Cambridge philosophy at the moment, that we do have some there are philosophers who have made important contributions to our understanding of previous generations of philosophers, in particular Wittgenstein. We have Michael Potter here, who's made important contributions to the understanding of the early Wittgenstein, and Jane Deal to that of the later Wittgenstein, which again makes me another reason to be nervous in this career life. So, what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you a little bit about Alfred North Whitehead, the man, and his career in Cambridge and afterwards. And then I'm going to try and tell you about his philosophy and see how much we can bring back to life in the time available to us. I'm going to chop through this fairly rapidly, but I've put it on your handout on the first page of the section two. Whitehead was born in 1861 in Ramsgate. So he was 40 in 1901 when Queen Victoria died, so he was indeed a genuine Victorian, I think. And he went to Sherborne to study mathematics and classics in 1875. I've noted that he became head boy and captain of games, which is interesting. A lot of the obituaries you find of Whitehead, they mention that he was head and captain of games. In 1880, he was awarded a scholarship to study mathematics at Trinity here in Cambridge, and eventually emerged from the mathematics degree as a fourth wrangler. You probably are wranglers, maybe a wrangler here, they can tell us, but I think it's the order in which you come in the exam results for the mathematics practice. So he came fourth in his year. In 1885, he submitted a fellowship dissertation on Clark Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism, which will have some relevance to we'll discover later. And in 1884 to 80, he became an active member of the Cambridge Conversazione Society of the Apostles. And you might have heard of the society. I think it was, I'm not exactly sure when it was first instituted. I reckon it was probably in the 1840s. It was a secret meeting of Cambridge intellectuals, many of them undergraduates, who would meet to discuss what they perceived to be important questions. You might have heard of it rather later on. Russell, Moore, and Wittgenstein were all apostles. And many members of the Bloomsbury group who passed in Cambridge were apostles as well. And the group became notorious in the 1950s because, of course, the Cambridge Spire was at any rate, the young Whitehead became an apostle. The only references I can find to it is that he gave a paper on Democritus or Heraclitus, and there was a vote as to which philosopher preferred. Heraclitus, of course, thought the world was all flux. Democritus thought that the world consisted of atoms. So is the world flux or atoms? That's all that we know. In 1888, he was appointed to lecture in mathematics and became a teaching fellow at Girton. And then in 1890, Russell arrived to study mathematics in Cambridge and was taught by Whitehead. And we know from Russell's autobiography that Whitehead was extraordinarily perfect as a teacher. So they clearly got on well. In 1891, he married Evelyn Wade, who was an Irish woman who'd been brought up in France, a devout Catholic. Whitehead was an Anglican, and this led to a period of, not so much crisis as prolonged reflection on whether or not he should move over to Catholicism. In 1896, because of this, he went to visit Cardinal Newman, who was beatified by the Pope so recently. Quite what they talked about, we don't know. In 1898, he published a treatise of universal algebra. which was his first major work, in which he tried to establish, he was reflecting on issues about classes and extensions. He was engaged in a project of trying to fulfill something which Leibniz had suggested, of providing a calculus for pure reason, a formula language which will enable us to express rational thought in its clearest form, so that we can investigate any subject matter with absolute logical clarity. Because of this work, he was elected a fellow of the Royal Society in 1903. And around this time, he and Russell and Whitehead, Russell now emerged under his wing to become a full-fledged mathematician and philosopher in his own right, and they began to work on their three-volume work, Principia Mathematica. So it's my computer's been like mathematics. Principia Mathematica is a work in which Russell and Whitehead attempted to take the language of mathematics and transcribe it into purely logical terms and derive the fundamental truths of mathematics from the fundamental truths of logic. This is an enormous work. It took them 10 years to write it, to try and transcribe all of mathematics, the part of mathematics they were concerned with, into logic. And apparently they had to take the proofs to CUP, Cambridge University Press, in the wheelbarrow. Now, in this period of joint endeavour between Russell and Whitehead, Whitehead published a memoir, which in the proceedings of the Royal Society called for Mathematical Concepts of the Material World. And this was for the first time where Whitehead, who was of course a mathematician, had turned his eye to the philosophy of the physical sciences. I'll come back to explain some of what was going on there shortly. Unfortunately, despite the fact he'd been appointed to the Royal Society and his book on a treatise on universal algebra had been well received, he couldn't get appointed to a permanent position in Cambridge. So he left and went to London, first became a reader of applied mathematics at UCL, and then became a professor at Imperial College. And then for several years worked in the administration of the University of London. In fact, I'm sure he's turning in his grave now that the University of London is disintegrating, which he worked so hard over those years to put together. In this period, he published three works, which according to my understanding of Whitehead are basically the work that he was doing in the first decade of the 20th century here in Cambridge. They're called The Principles of Natural Knowledge in 1919, The Concept of Nature from 1920, and The Principles of Relativity from 1922. We'll come back to those works in a moment. In 1924, however, Whitehead was appointed professor of philosophy at Harvard University, stayed there until 1937. During the period of his appointment in Harvard, he published a series of speculative metaphysical works, which he became famous for, not merely amongst philosophers, but amongst a much wider public. So these are the works Science in the Modern World, Religion in the Making, Symbolism, Its Meaning and Effect, Process and Reality, Adventures of Ideas, Nature of Life, and Modes of Thought. In light of this work, he was elected first to the Fellow of the British Academy and then awarded an Order of Merit, and died in 1947. Looking back on Whitehead's work, Charlie Dunbar Broad, who was a Knightsbridge professor, Knightsbridge professor of philosophy in Cambridge in the 40s and the 50s, who was a predecessor of Tim, who's our current Knightsbridge professor, he wrote the following in the obituary in Mind in 1948, this is on section 3 of your handout. It's been given to few men to start a new career in a new country at the age of 63, and thereafter to spend at least 20 more years of extremely original intellectual activity of the highest quality along quite fresh lines. Whitehead's output during this last period would be astonishing even in a man still in the prime of life. It is extraordinary that he wrote these highly speculative works on such a wide variety of subjects in the last 20 years of his life. Nonetheless, I think these later works, which no doubt have no value, have obscured from us the contribution that Whitehead made, which had an impact on the Cambridge triumvirate and on the success of Cambridge philosophy. They were indeed very speculative, and the general view of them by subsequent philosophy is rather captured very well by this quotation, the Commit quotation I've given you, which is from John Passmore, who's a distinguished Australian philosopher from his book 100 Years of Philosophy. Here's his remarks on Whitehead: the shifts of opinion, the obscurity and looseness of expression, the elusiveness of his multitudinous references, these together produce in the chronicler of contemporary thought a feeling of desperation. No one will ever succeed in writing a short account of his work, which is not a high degree of arbitrary. So based on these later works, philosophers just didn't know what to do with them. Even earlier, Susan Stebbing, who was an undergraduate here in Girton, and went on to become a professor at Bedford College London, she wrote, "We are not likely to ever know exactly what he means." A basis of studying science in the modern world. Nonetheless, C.D. Broad, our eventual professor, he wrote a critical notice of the Principles of Natural Knowledge in Mind in 1920, and he said, whilst it's distinctly difficult, and he felt beholden to offer first aid to critics, he nevertheless thought the work was very important. And a few years later, Richard Braithwaite, another Leicester professor, he wrote, "I am a sincere admirer of Dr. Whitehead's philosophy, and I am convinced the truth about the natural world lies somewhere along his lines." What Braithwaite was doing there was he was looking back to the earlier works of Whitehead in this period when he first went to London, evolving the material that he'd produced in Cambridge. And it's that work that I want to look at now. Now that there's a genuine debt of the triumvirate to Whitehead, it's difficult to argue with. One of Russell's famous works, Our Knowledge of the External World, which he published in 1914, for Lowell Lectures in Harvard, he's very clear at this time. He explains quite the enormous debt to Whitehead that's owed. So this is the quotation from the top of page 2. In this work, Russell wants to understand how we can know about the external world, how we can know about the world that's given to us in experience which science investigates. Here's what he says. "The central problem by which I have sought to illustrate method is the problem of the relation between the crude data of sense," that's what we directly experience, "and the space, time, and matter of mathematical physics." So how do we go from what we directly experience to these very sophisticated, understanding the very complex world of mathematical physics? "I've been made aware of the importance of this problem by my friend and collaborator, Dr. Whitehead, to whom are due all the differences between the view advocated here and the suggested problems of philosophy. I owe to him the definition of points, the suggestion for the treatment of instants and things, and the whole conception of the world as a construction rather than inference. What is said on these topics here is in fact a rough preliminary account of the more precise results which he is giving in the fourth volume of our Principia Mathematica. It was seen that if his way of dealing with these topics is capable of being carried through, a wholly new light is thrown on the time-honoured controversies of realists and idealists, and a method is obtained of solving all that is soluble in their problem." Now, I'm sure some of that paragraph is a little bit difficult to digest if you're not used to philosophy, but I'm hoping that what I'm going to talk about in the next 20 minutes will enable you to understand what he's telling us in this paragraph. The historical fact, which is you can take straight away though, is that the material which Russell was taking on board from Whitehead is material that was due to be published in the fourth volume of their Principia Mathematica. So the three volumes that were actually published between 1910 and 1913, they concern mathematics proper. There was going to be a fourth volume, and the fourth volume was going to be written by Whitehead, and it was going to be about geometry. And the material which is being drawn on here is about geometry. But it's this very same material which, in fact, Whitehead is talking about, I believe, in 1919, 20, and 22, when we get to the works he published shortly after arriving in London. So I think what we're really seeing here is we're seeing the fourth volume of Principia, published independently by Whitehead. It's just merely that it was suppressed for a period because he had to leave Cambridge and was drawn off into administrative work. Now, let me try and give you a sense of what Whitehead was doing. To do so, I think we need to go back to 1906. So 1906, I think I recall, he published this memoir on the Proceedings of the Royal Society. And in that memoir, And what Whitehead strove to do was to attack the classical concept of the material world, which he took to be the Newtonian conception of natural science. Now, what was this Newtonian conception as he understood it? Well, it's that the material world consists of three classes of entities. On the one hand, we have space. On the other hand, we have time. And then we have the occupants of space and time, and which are particles of matter. And what the Newtonian scientist is doing is explaining the way in which particles move by assigning them to points in space and points in time. Now, Whitehead's complaint about this conception of the natural world was that it left it entirely arbitrary, as he puts it, an accidental fact about nature that a particle occupies a point at an instant. We think of ordinary objects occupying, you know, we are here at this particular place at this particular time, and this view of the universe is distilled by the scientists in thinking of what we're made up out of are particular point particles which occupy particular moments, which occupy a point at an instant. This sounds very familiar, but Whitehead had this quite rarefied concern, which is that it's an accident that time, space, and the occupants of time and space should go together in the natural world. There was no reason within you might have had space without time, or time without space, for all that Newtonian tells us. Or you might have had a particle which didn't occupy any time or any space. What he wanted to do was to give us an account which showed, give us an integrated account of reality, so it wasn't an accident. We could see why it is that ordinary objects and the more rarefied point particles described by physics should be things inside space and time. He elaborates on various ways of spelling out the Newtonian conception and offers a fifth. He gives us four different versions of the Newtonian conception of that work, and he gives a fifth, an alternative conception. Now, this is all given in highly mathematical terms, but I think we can see the very same motivation coming to play when we look at his later works coming in 1919 and 1920. And so here's a quotation, which is the next part of your next large quotation in your handout. The false idea which we have to get rid of is that of nature as a mere aggregate of independent entities, a jumble of space and time and points, each capable of isolation. According to this conception, these entities whose characters are capable of isolated definition come together and by their accidental relations form the system of nature. With this theory of space, space may be without time and time may be without space. The relations between portions of matter and space are accidental facts owing to the absence of any coherent account of how space springs from matter or how matter springs from space. The explanation of nature, which I urge as an alternative idea to this accidental view of nature, is that nothing in nature could be what it is except as an ingredient in nature as it is. So he thinks there's something disordered. There's a lack of coherence to our understanding of the Newtonian conception, and he's going to give us something else alternative that's in its place. That's one of his main motivations. Another of his motivations is an attack on what he called the bifurcation of nature. Whitehead held a thoroughgoing realism about the external world. What we perceive in the world is something which is given entirely independently of us, which doesn't owe itself in any way to our perception of it. So he's not an idealist. And he wants to be a very thoroughgoing idealist. He thinks everything that we see is real. So if you go to the second quotation on page 3, we may not pick and choose, he says. We may not pick and choose. For us, the rain and the sunset should be as much part of nature as are the molecules and electric waves by which men of science could explain the phenomena. It's all real. And it's only if we accept all the reality of all of this that we're able to avoid the threat of skepticism. So skepticism, the threat of Cartesian skepticism is the threat that we may not know anything whatsoever, that for all we know, light might be... We might be deeply deluded about what life is really like. The world may not be as it seems. He thought in order to avoid skepticism, to secure our knowledge, as it's expressed through natural science, we have to admit that everything that we encounter is real. So this is what he writes. In considering knowledge, We should wipe out all these spatial metaphors, such as within the mind and without the mind. This idea that somehow red is to do with, you know, colour is somehow something in our mind, is the way a matter of a psychic addition is sometimes looks at. And then we have to explain how we get from, as it were, the veil of ideas or impressions that confront us directly outside to the world in itself. He thinks if you start thinking in those terms, as many philosophers have done, then you will never explain how we have knowledge of the external world. Rather, what you have to do is you have to admit that everything we perceive is real, and we shouldn't have the idea of what's inside the mind and contrast that with outside the mind. Let's continue this quotation. Knowledge is ultimate. Natural knowledge is the knowledge from within nature. And we should realise that knowledge itself is something that belongs to the natural environment. And there's an awareness of the natural relations of one element in nature, what he calls the percipient event, or as he sometimes calls it, the bodily life of the incarnate mind, to the rest of nature. So to understand how we have knowledge, we have to see ourselves as a natural organism situated in the natural world, and we have to understand the relations between them. This realism not only extends to the deliverances of our senses, the colours and the smells and the shapes, it also extends to scientific particles. He thinks these are completely, these are fundamental, just as fundamentally real. What he's doing in these next two passages is he's counteracting a popular view at the time that somehow when scientists talk about atoms or other particles, they don't really mean what they're saying. There aren't really any atoms. It's just a picturesque way of talking, which enables us to predict when we'll see the next, when we'll see the needle move on the experimental data or something of that sort. Talk of atoms is just a way of predicting how ordinary objects behave. He thinks this, he just dismisses this very cursorily. He says, the current answer to these objections is that atoms are merely conceptual. They are interesting and picturesque ways of seeing something else which is true of nature. So there aren't really any atoms. Talk of atoms is just a way of predicting, a useful way of summing up data about how macroscopic objects behave. But then he says, surely there's something else that you mean. For heaven's sake, say it. Do away with the elaborate machinery of conceptual nature which consists of assertions about things which don't exist in order to convey truths about things which do exist. So he wants to say, look, let's take scientists seriously. If they could do without, if atoms aren't real, they should be able to give us a science which doesn't mention atoms. They do have to mention atoms, so we ought to be realists about them as well. Okay, so, see, I think we have this, on the one hand, we have this dissatisfaction with Newtonian science on the one hand, which makes space and time somehow arbitrary. On the other hand, we have this profound realism about the deliverances of the senses and of science, which we must hold on to in order to stave off skepticism. How does Whitehead think that we can overcome the skepticism on the one hand and the difficulties of Newtonian science on the other? Well, his primary idea is that we need to change the plurality of two of the fundamental categories of our thought. And these two categories are that of object and event. And these are what I'm going to be talking about for the remainder, 10 minutes or so. Now, we're at a particular event right now. This is the alumni weekend, and we are all participants in that event. There are other types of events that we could talk about. We could talk about hurricanes. We could talk about famines, we could talk about wars. Unfortunately, most of the examples of events that philosophers give are rather dark ones. That's often because they're the ones that we give names to. But also, you know, there are births and there are marriages and so on. And what's distinctive of all these events is that there are objects that participate in them. It's because of what the objects do and the way that they undergo changes that we say that an event takes place. So in our ordinary way of thinking, it seems that what's fundamental are things like you and I that take place in the alumni weekend or take place in the battle. And it's because of the way that we shift relationships between us, that we all come together in the room, we participate and engage in philosophy. That's what makes the event what it is. What Whitehead's primary idea is that's the wrong way around. We've got to turn our thinking upside down. What's actually primary is not the objects that participate in the events, it's the events. What happened? What reality is a succession of overlapping events. And we objects, we think we're the things that give life to the events, but we are, as it were, are what emerges from the events. We are what are in common to different events. So a variety of different events have taken place since you got up this morning. Your alarm went off, you stood up, you got out of bed, and so on. You walked to the Citrix site. You think you did those things. That's not quite the right way to think about it if you're going to be utterly perspicuous. Rather, those events happened, and you are a persistent feature of those events. That's what Whitehead believed. Now, and something like that, I suspect, is what most contemporary philosophers believe. Particularly when you reflect that Whitehead's events are very similar to the facts that were advanced by Russell and Wittgenstein to be fundamental constituents of reality. That's something to talk for another time now. So why did Whitehead think that taking events as primary was so important? Well, so we go to the beginning of section 6 and find out. In order to stave off scepticism, Whitehead wanted to take the deliverances of our senses with utmost seriousness. And what he thinks that we primarily perceive is not objects, things like you or I. What we perceive are events. So here we go. What sense awareness delivers for knowledge is nature through a period. Our knowledge of nature is an experience of activity or passage. You see things happening. You see things passing. You see events. The things previously observed are active entities, the events. So you don't just look out at a passive world. It's not just frozen. It's not like looking at a still frame. What you look out and see is you see time, the universe in passage. You don't perceive the world instantaneously. What you perceive is something happening. It might be happening extremely slowly, or it might even be in stasis, but nonetheless you have the perception of time passing as you look out. So even if nothing is moving in the frame directly presented to you, you realize that something is happening for each moment that you're conscious of the world. So we thought, if we're going to be serious about the relevance of the senses, we need to take seriously that is what the world is made of. Happenings. The world universe in passage. Now, what is this universe in passage? What is this event? Well, he goes on to say the next quotation. The event is not mere space-time, which is a further interaction. An event is qualified space-time. Or rather, the qualities of space-time are both further abstractions than the more concrete event. This is kind of difficult to understand, but his idea is that the fundamental unit of being is the universe in passage, in creative advance, evolving through time. We take in perception, you appreciate a minor passage, a minor excerpt from that passage. Like listening to a symphony, you hear a quick chunk of one of the themes of the symphony, and that each perception you have is like that. And his idea is that the individuals are somehow abstracted out from that whole. So just as you can isolate an individual note when you listen to a melody for appreciating the melody, I appreciate each of you, or you appreciate my presence here, by virtue of understanding me as this recurrent theme that shows up in the course of the string in the music that's being played by the universe. The space and time themselves are abstractions out of the manifold events. You appreciate space and time in the sense which the scientists are interested in by appreciating the way in which the universe evolves. Okay, so I'm going to quickly... Sorry, running out of time here. I'm going to quickly try and explain to you how it is that Whitehead tries to explain how this works. I mean, he does so in a highly mathematical fashion, which is what you'd expect from a professor of applied mathematics. But nonetheless, he does make a variety of remarks which I think will help us see this more or less clearly. Using some of the ideas from his early work a treatise on universal algebra, using some of these ideas, Whitehead introduced the idea of extension. And extension for him was a part-whole relation. And his claim was that a universe is composed of events, and there's this fundamental relation that orders them, this part-whole relation. And we have a intuitive idea of what this means. Because we think of So we're now coming to the later part of my talk. So the talk was an event, and there are various parts that make up that talk. And a human life, well, that's a very long event, and the part of that includes the childhood, is the adolescence, and so forth. So we have this intuitive idea of events having parts, and large events subsuming smaller events. And his idea is the passage of nature, the creative advance of time, involves the addition of larger events that subsume previous events. So as time advances, more and more events are added onto their predecessors. So look at the middle of the quotation in the middle of page 4. An event in passing becomes part of larger events, and thus the passage of events is extension in the making. So what it means for time to move forward for the notion of extension to progress in that way. Now, what's interesting about the notion of extension is that using it by a variety of constructions, Whitehead goes on to try and explain how space and time, as described by the physicists, actually make sense. And you can see his suggestion on page 4. Space and time are each partial expressions of one fundamental relation, which is neither spatial nor temporal. This relation I call extension. The relation of extending over is the relation of including, either in a spatial or in a temporal sense, or in both. So the idea is we've got this manifold of events with this partial relation called extension. And by looking at extension from different perspectives, we'll see it either as spatial or as temporal. And that's the fundamental of activity of the physicists really consists in. Now I'm going to give you the constructions are complicated, but I'm going to give you an idea of one of the constructions he gives, which is called the method of extensive abstraction, which is meant to give us some insight into how physics actually succeeds. The method of extensive abstraction is the idea that, if you recall from the earlier quotation from Russell, he mentions that he got from Whitehead the idea of a logical construction. And the idea of a logical construction is where we may think we're talking about some very definite entity. So when the physicist talks about space-time point, we think they're talking about some particular thing. Whitehead's thought was that they're not. They're not talking about some particular thing. They're actually talking in a very complicated way about many different things. So in a sense, we're rather deluded. We read off from the surface features of language. To give you an analogy, you might think of the notion of the average man as a logical construction. There is no average man walking around the streets. What you mean when you talk about the average man is you mean something which is arrived at by making calculations about what are done by all the different men and women who say go out to shops on Saturdays, and you say the average person who went shopping on Saturday did such and such, or spent such and such money. You're not really talking about one particular person, you're talking about what's distributively true, collectively true of all the different people who went shopping. Now, here's what he does. So he doesn't believe in nature as an instant, but that's exactly what a space-time point would be. And that's part of the reason he doesn't like Newtonian science, because it talks about, it tries to capture nature without its passage by talking about instantaneous points. But there aren't any. So it looks as though that what Whitehead has to say is that science has got it wrong. It's talking about all these space-time points, and there aren't any. But he doesn't want to say that, because even Newtonian physics, even before we got the physics that succeeded, was very, very successful. So he's going to explain why Newtonian is successful. And the way he does it is he gives a way of thinking about what it's describing, which doesn't commit into the existence of space-time points, which don't exist. So his idea is that for any stretch of passage of nature, we can sort of see, the best way to draw it, so here's time advancing. According to the Newtonian physics, this is a succession of points. But there aren't any points according to this view of things. Rather, what we experience are chunks of nature. So how can we reconcile these two images? Well, his answer is to appeal to the notion of an abstractive set. So the top quotation on page 5. An abstractive set of events is any set of events which possesses the two properties of any two members of the set, one contains the other as a part, and two, there is no event which is a common part of every member of the set. Well, the way
to make sense of that thing is that he's thinking of, he talks about a Chinese toy. I think more of a Russian doll. So you have a Russian doll which has got a doll, and there's a doll inside the doll. And inside that doll, there's another doll. Now, so take any of the dolls that are inside this large doll, you'll find that each one of them, except for the last, is going to be a member inside one of the other dolls. Now, what's the stick think of this as the smallest doll? So it's that big. Now, what he's asking us to imagine is that, so explain us that there are no absolutely small points. There are no infinitesimal points. But he thinks that however much you divide the x-ray, you'll find something else which is a bit smaller. So you've got to imagine taking a Russian doll apart, and every time you get to a smaller one, you find a still smaller one. You never get to one that's completely without indivisible. You'll just keep finding smaller and smaller things. So, shall we draw this way? So inside this region here, we find this other region. Inside it. And then his claim is that if we look inside that, we'll find another one. And if we keep on going, we'll find another. And so on. And his claim is each one of these will be extended. It will be nature in passage. But it will always be something smaller which can be discerned. And this will just go on and on and on. And his claim is that what the physicist really means when they're talking about a point is they're talking about one of these Russian dolls, figures applied to events, going all the way down, such that any part will find a smaller part, a smaller event that comprises it. So the Roman numeral 2, there is no event which is a common part of every member of the set. If there were a common part, which is a member of every member of those events, then of course the last one would be the bottom one. And there is no bottom one, it just goes on and on and on. So in some ideas, this is a trail off into infinite reaches right there. And his claim is that if you think of a space-time point, it's effectively what you reach at the figurative ideal of that limit of infinite interaction. That's what the physicist is going to gesture towards. But we don't need to believe in the figurative limit of this ideal of this enumeration. Rather, we can just simply take what the physicist is talking about is the whole set, all of those ever smaller regions. And that's really all that we need to believe in. We don't need to believe in the smallest point, we just need to believe in this infinite succession of ever divisible events, all of which exhibit features of passage in nature. So, it's the last quotation I'll give you. Thus, an abstractive set is effectively the entity meant, so this is the middle of page 5, when we consider an instance of time without temporal extension. It subserves all the necessary purposes of giving a definite meaning to the concept of the properties of nature of an instance. So, he doesn't believe in instance, but we can make do with infinite regions of things which are not instantaneous. Okay, let me give one closing thought about the nature of objects in his view. I'll just read the first line of the next quotation. Objects are elements in nature which do not pass. An object is an ingredient in the character of some event. We're still here. We've survived to the end of this lecture. We're the elements which have remained through the sixth of this event as time's passing is added to it. Whitehead's view is that it's only by understanding ourselves to be objects in that sense that we can really understand some of the elements of contemporary physics. A lot of his reason for thinking that is that he thinks that in actual fact to understand the nature of an object, you actually need to understand us not as being rather as philosophers only call particulars, but rather we are in a sense universals. So philosophers often make a distinction between particulars, which things can only be in one place at a time. We can only be in one place at a time, unfortunately. But the properties that we exhibit can be in many different places at a time. So each of us is a human being. That universal property, that one over many, that's common to each of us. Each of us is a human being. So the universal, or the property of being a human being, is instanced many different times in this room. It's in many different places. It's in all these chairs, even though each of us can only be in one. In a sense, Whitehead wants to say that's wrong. There's a sense in which we as objects, perceived of as the commonalities to events, are in fact arranged throughout the universe. We are actually contributing to the entire network of reality, even as we sit here. We have some special role here, but in a way that's an illusion. I'll read you a couple more of these lines. So it's got the first quotation on page 6. An object is ingredient throughout its neighbourhood, and its neighbourhood is indefinite. We are driven to admit that each object is in some sense ingredient throughout nature, even though its ingression may be quantitatively irrelevant in expression of our individual experience. He suggests that this is rather suggested by Faraday's theory of tubes of force, and a lot of it will strike a chord with contemporary field theory, where the idea is that space-time is fundamental, and that fields are basically properties of space-time, and what we think of as macroscopic objects are sort of torrents or protuberances of forces over space-time. He thinks that we can appreciate this view without being really going down this route. So in the quotation after next, we can, however, illustrate the doctrine by the more familiar facts of life without recourse to the abstract speculations of theoretical physics. The waves as they roll the Cornish coast tell of a gale in mid-Atlantic, and this one I like, and our dinner witnesses to the ingression of the cook in the dining room. So the dinner is here on the table, and that must be because of the cook. The waves are rolling in because of what's happening in mid-Atlantic. And his view is that ultimately we can only make sense of that by thinking, well, actually, in a sense, the object which consists, which is the commonality of a variety of events that the cook contributes to, she is an affecting ingredient, not only in where she's standing, but she's also present everywhere that the food goes, everywhere that the influences of the food are in turn. So we end up thinking that actually, in a sense, you're present throughout the universe. And he thinks this, thinking along these lines is what's required to make sense of contemporary physics. And of course, so let me finish up by these two points. So his claim is that to avoid the excesses of many of his contemporary views, we need to turn the event object duality the other way around. Objects are features of events rather than the other way. And he also turns the particular universal distinction upside down. Things we thought were particulars, like you and I, turn out to be universal features of events. One final word. I talked about his his concerns with religion. Where does religion go in this picture? Well, we are commonalities to events. We're recurrent patterns that emerge through events. God eventually emerges in his later philosophy as the pattern that's common to all the events that make up the entire universe. So, rather wonderfully for an applied mathematician, he actually ends up thinking of God as the abstract axiomatic structure, which is exhibited by the totality of events that make up the universe. Also there, thank you.
Before, I know that some of you will want the constituents of other events.